Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 41. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Fury, a film by David Ayer. And in the past, David Ayer has made some really great films, and he's made some slightly more head-scratchingly not as good films. But this one, starring Brad Pitt, Shia LaBeouf, Logan Lerman, Michael Pena, and John Bernthal, has drawn lots of people to the theater. It's done quite well so far, and overall, it has been accepted critically by mostly fans and critics alike. So it's doing quite well. It continues to usher in an October of shifting films where the films seem to be getting a little bit better. They begin to get a little deeper and definitely give us a lot more to talk about. In this film, we see so many things that are worthy of our discussion. I mean, we even have to take time to talk about, is this a war film or is this an anti-war film? So when we talk about that, we break down things like why do people like war films? Why do people prefer anti-war films? Do you have to have a certain personality or a certain belief or a certain disposition to like one over the other? We talk about Shia LaBeouf's supposed conversion, and we know for the hope that we have in that. We talk about God, his role in war, his justice, and where that fits in. And to do that, Wade Bearden joins me. Wade, if you are a listener of this podcast, you probably recognize him from a couple of the episodes. He's a great resource, wadebearden.com, and also our very own Josh Crabb. He's getting his feet wet a little bit more, and you can continue to find the stuff that he's doing over at Real World Theology. Both of those guys join us for an excellent conversation, so I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. So here it is, episode 41, Fury and the Anti-War Film. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
Man, I love Letterboxd talking to you on there and Josh on there.
I'm so glad that I finally got other people on there.
Man, I had it. I got it when it was beta, and I never used it. I think I did a couple things, and I just stopped. And then now I got back on. And I'm like, man, this is so much fun. Like, you can write miniature reviews, and
I
love it. Like, I get on there every day. I'm like, I want to see what my friends are. But a lot of the people that I know, in real life, like people I talk to face to face, none of them have Letterboxd. It's all my internet friends.
But your internet friends are way cooler.
Dude, they're cool. And you know what? They're not as needy. Friends aren't as needy.
No, they're like, hey, man, when can you be on? Whenever. That's cool.
You know, it's awesome, dude. Reply whenever.
when it's good for you.
Mm-hmm. I've checked Letterboxd 7 times since you guys have been talking.
Are you on here? He's just spying on us. I thought I heard somebody snickering in the background.
Yeah, he's creeping. He's the internet creeper.
That's awesome.
I was going to interject, but you guys were having such a fascinating conversation. I was just enjoying checking out Letterboxd.
Yeah, man.
Looking at Nathan Rabin's short review of Pinocchio.
Oh, man, classic, huh? I just put up The New World, the Terrence Malick one. I just watched that one.
I have never even seen that movie or heard of that movie, and
doesn't it have like Clive Owen in it or something? Or
hello, I'm Clive Owen.
Colin Farrell is
Colin
in it.
Farrell.
Christian Bale. Christian Bale's in the last part of it too. Yeah.
I really need to sit down and watch some Terrence Malick films because the few that I recall having seen. Mm-hmm. I do not like, or I remember like hating. Mm-hmm. I mean, Josh and I were just talking about how much I love war movies.
Yeah.
And I remember when someone got me The Thin Red Line and I was like, this is the worst war movie I've ever seen in my life. And I love, like, I'm a huge fan of like Veterans Day and Memorial Day, because they just had the marathons on like TNT, like Operation TNT, where they just show like old war movies all day.
Yeah.
I would just sit in front of my TV and watch like John Wayne war movies. So I can put up with bad war movies. For some reason, I was like, this is terrible.
I was very moved by it. I feel like with Malick, you need to go in knowing that the style and the narrative and his storytelling is going to be different than most other films. So if you go in and you think, okay, the Thin Red Line is going to be like Saving Private Ryan, then you're going to probably be a little disappointed. But if you go in kind of understanding how Malick crafts narratives and you kind of just immerse yourself in it, I feel like his films are always – they're just beautiful films. Like I always walk away feeling kind of emotional and artistically invigorated after I watch his films. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm going to – I'm not – I don't watch them over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. They're not those type of films for me, though I think that you could watch it multiple times and still enjoy them. But yeah, no, I think it might be good to kind of maybe start at some of his older stuff, Badlands, or and then kind of work your way up.
Yeah, that was kind of the conversation that I was having with Josh when he posted his top five war movies and we started talking about The Thin Red Line. Mm. I really want to go back, understanding that this – like when he does things, they're going to be slightly different, and he's going to approach it from an angle that most directors and storytellers don't do it from, so I can appreciate it in a different way. Because honestly, I haven't seen any, like Tree of Life has been like in my queue for a long time. Wow. And it just never gets there. The one he made with,
To the Wonder.
Yeah. To the Wonder. I was gonna say with Ben Affleck or whatever. Yeah. Also in my queue for a very long time. I just haven't got to them. So I would say that since I have begun watching movies more critically,
yeah,
and with a more discerning eye, I have not seen a Terrence Malick film.
Yeah.
And I feel like as someone who reviews / critiques, you know, / expounds upon the themes in movies, I have done a great disservice to myself not having gone back to experience some of these films. So yeah, it is on my to-do list.
Yeah, I would definitely do that. No, I would. I really do enjoy his films. I really do. So yeah, no, I think that'd be good. I feel like there was a lot in a Thin Red Line that lined up with Fury, in that Thin Red Line is also about the horrors of war and the moral conflict of war. And so there, some of the same themes are kind of touched on.
Yeah, and I definitely want to talk about, at some point, the concept of the war movie, the balance between war movie and anti-war movie.
Hmm.
Because I feel like most of the most liked war movies are actually like either overtly or subtly anti-war movies, because they show us, like, you know, the horrors of war.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, how do you feel about that, Josh?
Yeah.
Just being an internet creeper, man.
I'm getting myself up to it.
Skype voyeur.
No, I mean, see, the thing with Fury is that the movie definitely has like that bent, but I don't think that David Ayer was necessarily setting out to do that. When you listen to like the motivations he had behind the movie, he definitely wasn't going for what like Malick was trying to do with The Thin Red Line. Or, I mean, I guess The Thin Red Line's, you know, isn't it a book? I think it's a book. Maybe it's not.
Yeah, it was originally a book.
Yeah.
I would assume probably, though, the book is very different from the movie. I haven't read the book. I would probably assume that.
Yeah, but. And you know, because like The Thin Red Line, I mean, is definitely like, you know, as the whole movie progresses, it just, you know, the cinematography and everything in the movie changes, and the attitude of the movie changes as time goes on. And there's some pretty horrible, brutal stuff in the movie, like even from both sides. I mean, I think it's in that movie where there's just like the scene of, you know, they've got those machine guns set up, and they just the Japanese soldiers just charging constantly and getting mowed down constantly. I'm pretty sure that that's not. I don't think that's from Band of Brothers, the Pacific.
The scene that really hit me is when the American soldiers are running through the Japanese camp. And so you have a lot of people who – a lot of the enemy soldiers who are, you know, not ready or, you know, they don't have their guns and they're just going through and just shooting and shooting and shooting and hitting prisoners, right, hitting right. people who surrendered. And so that was a pretty harrowing scene. And so it reminds me a lot of like, yeah, of Fury in that way.
Yeah, and just, you know, I mean, I think Fury really hits home almost to from a movie standpoint, almost too hard in the first 15 minutes just how, like, brutal war actually is. And it's just like a constant, like, you know, this is war is hell for, like, 15 minutes to start it off. And, it lets up a little bit, but it's definitely, like, you leave the movie just feeling like you just got beat up.
Wait, did you say Fury, or are we still talking about Thin Red Line?
Oh, no, I'm talking about Fury. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Thin Red Line is beautiful and moving. I feel like Fury is a different experience than the Thin Red Line.
Mm-hmm.
The Thin Red Line is very much like it's much more reserved. It's much more. It's not nearly as. It's more contemplative than, you know, like Fury or Saving Private Ryan. Whereas mm-hmm. Fury is much more just like an intense, like it's basically like if you can pack the punch of an action movie with sort of like this overt message of, you know, that just war is brutal and hellacious.
Well, let me do this for the listeners. Let's set the scene, I guess, because we've already started kind of giving some first impressions of Fury. And I wanted to make sure that, like I said, we kind of fence the table, so to speak. So, like, Fury is directed and the screenplay was written by David Ayer. And David Ayer is someone who has, in my opinion, done some very great films and done some very terrible films. most people point to Training Day as one of his best films. And I think it comes off very similar to Fury, just in a different environment.
Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't direct that, did he?
I think he just wrote it.
He wrote that in Fast and Furious, where his first like two writing credits, I think.
So he's done a number of things. He did End of Watch, which I haven't had a chance to see yet. I think it was Josh. You said you watched it recently.
Yeah, and Wade did too.
Yeah, I watched it the other day. And
both you guys are better at watching movies than I am.
There are some similarities too with the. Like, he's really with End of Watch, he's trying to say, like, hey, being a police officer is really tough.
Yeah.
But he focuses on the relationship of the officers. And so there is, like, kind of a connection point between that and Fury. And it's like, hey, like, war is tough. But he does that through the lens of the relationship between these five guys in this metal tank. Mm-hmm. And so I was watching End of Watch right after I saw Fury, and
oh, wow.
I could see,
cool.
You know, there are a lot of connections there with these themes. And I feel like Ayers is trying to honor police officers in End of Watch, and he's trying to honor the soldiers by explaining, hey, there are a lot of – I mean, war is difficult, and two, there's a lot of moral complexity that comes along with war. And it's tough on the soldiers. So, yeah, there seems to be, like, a really good connection. And End of Watch is on Netflix for those who haven't had a chance to see it. It's a very good film.
Yep. Also, sitting in my queue, probably right ahead of a Terrence Malick film. Well, the thing about Fury that I did like was that even though it drew comparisons to lots of other films, especially, you know, lots of other war films, there's not a lot of tank movies. Tanks aren't flashy, typically, and most of the older movies that involve tank battles, there's like lots of tanks involved, so it kind of has this cinematic, like, huge, grand scale feel to it, and this one actually kind of takes that tank concept and does the exact opposite. It says this is a small compact unit. And so, you know, IMDb says, in April 1945, as the Allies make their final push in the European theater, a battle-hardened Army sergeant named War Daddy commands a Sherman tank and his five-man crew on a deadly mission behind enemy lines. Outnumbered, outgunned, and with a rookie soldier thrust into their platoon, War Daddy and his men face overwhelming odds in their heroic attempts to strike at the heart of Nazi Germany. Which is interesting, because that's not exactly how I would describe what kind of mission they're on.
No, I feel like that is super, like, cliche war film, you know, synopsis.
Oh yeah.
And it doesn't do justice to the film.
And I think that's the interesting thing, because I think there's a number of films that we have talked about recently where I will give the synopsis, and the synopsis I believe is honestly misleading, because I think it would appeal to more people. The synopsis, you know, would appeal to more of a general audience. Yeah. Whereas I think if you talk about what this movie's really about, that people were like, "Well, that sounds kind of heady and not something I'd be interested in. I'm more interested in explosions."
Yeah.
Or at least that's what they feel the general public would want.
Yeah. No, I think so too. If you say, "Hey, this is a war that shows you that World War II soldiers, the Allies, weren't always that great. And that war is terrible, and there are a lot of moral complexities." Like, people are gonna be like, "Okay, cool. Well, I'll probably go see Saving Private Ryan again, or, you know, they'll go to another film."
Yeah, I'll go see Ouija.
Yeah,
the Ouija board. Yeah.
Well, I want to poke fun and say, "Oh, I'll just go see John Wick instead." But apparently, John Wick is pretty good.
I've heard good things. We'll see. Yeah. I guess.
I mean, it's rated pretty highly, and I'm watching the trailers for John Wick, and I'm just like, but it's still Keanu Reeves delivering lines badly. Obviously, they're not showing me something in the trailer that people are seeing when they see the full film. It's got me intrigued, though. But I mean, but the thing with Fury is that I assumed that they could be more honest with the synopsis because of the cast they had tied to it. I mean, you have Brad Pitt basically anchoring your cast. You know, there's a lot of backlash against Shia LaBeouf, much of it very deserved. But, I mean, Logan Learman, Michael Pena, John Bernthal, these guys are pretty recognizable right now. So it's not like this is just a cast of unknowns, because I would consider most of the people in Saving Private Ryan, outside of Tom Hanks, fairly unknown at the time.
Right.
I mean, most of them have gone on to do really great things.
Vin Diesel is in.
Yeah, Vin Diesel.
Yeah,
they should put him on the cover now. his face besides Tom Hanks. No, the cast is really great. Like, Brad Pitt's incredible. Like, he's one of my favorite actors. And his, I feel like his public persona takes away from his ability as an actor. But he is great in everything that he does. And he takes a role that could really be cliche, or he could be this just barking commander. And he becomes, in a sense, their dad. And he does phenomenal, but the rest of the cast, they just do well. And that's why this film works, is because you have a cast here that does, I mean, it does great. They're all very, very good, these five guys. And that's, I mean, that's one of the things that really stuck out to me. Because when I went to see Fury, I knew we were going to talk about it on the podcast. I didn't have super high hopes. I had middle range expectations, and it blew me away, right?
Yeah. When I was done, I was like, "Where did David Ayer pull this movie from?" Because it was so good, and it was intense. And, you know, I mean, I had a different feeling. Like, I think it's a toss up between him, this, and End of Watch is like kind of my favorite movie that he's directed. End of Watch was, I think, a little bit more emotional at the end of the movie, and. I mean, you can argue about whether both of these movies kind of end with a deus ex machina that kind of, you know, gives you that emotional punch that you're looking for, at least some sort of, like, not completely depressing resolution. But, man, yeah, I had no idea. I kind of took the same expectations that you took in, Wade. I wasn't really expecting that much of this movie. Like, I was like, "Oh, you know, it's Brad Pitt, and we're going to..." I had every intention of going into this movie knowing that we were going to be doing this, but there was no, I wasn't expecting what I got. And maybe I went in with a little bit higher expectations because I saw End of Watch before I saw Fury.
Yeah. I hadn't seen it yet. And so,
And so your expectations were just a smidge lower. than mine, because, you know, I was like, oh, End of Watch is good. Like, this is promising if the slope is going up for him, you know. But I wasn't expecting it to be as good as this, just because it was kind of – I mean, it isn't out of his element, because it is, you know, that idea of brotherhood, and that's what he's been really exploring in his movies. And, you know, I think he said in some recent interviews that he's really been exploring, like, you know, the brotherhood and camaraderie and sort of the idea of people who are thrusted into these roles, or sort of what he, I think the word he said is like basically drafted or like put up in these roles, and, you know, how they're able to sort of live and do and find redemption and find love and all these other things in the midst of, you know, inhumanity and a dangerous job.
Yeah. So I definitely have a viewpoint on this, but in your estimation, anti-war or pro-war? What is Fury?
Oh man, see, this is going to be my final question. This is a thesis question.
Okay, should we come back to this later?
No, let's get it out there.
Now, let's just dive right in, right?
Yeah, let's just do it, man.
So, anti-war or pro-war? Fury. The million-dollar question.
The first half is pro-war, the second half is anti-war.
okay, yeah.
I think one of the reasons that I like this film so much is because I think it's both.
Yeah.
I think it exists. There's like this duality to the movie where on one hand they are basically laying, or Ayers is basically laying, or Ayer is laying out an argument for why war is necessary. But at the same time, he also shows that war is completely deplorable.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, take the next step and say should be avoided at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason I wanted to ask this question, because I couldn't decide. I'm basically sitting right in the middle. And though I personally don't really, I don't agree with his arguments that I think he's working out in this movie for, you know, why war has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's making a really strong case, and I think it's a much better case than we see in most war movies that are 100% predictable. Even though one of my criticisms of the film when I gave like a quick little review on Letterboxd was, you know, like the formula is there, but the spice of that formula in this case is so different that you don't care that you can kind of see lots of the twists coming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think that the movie intentionally is not looking to be anti-war or pro-war. I think that the movie would have been a lot worse if it had tried to do that. Because I really think that it's exploring different things than the pro-anti-war, you know, pro-war message. It's really looking at – because you can look at the character of Shia LaBeouf's character, Bible. That's his nickname. I can't even remember what his real name is.
Oh, we can find out what his name is.
Yeah, I'm looking –
Boyd Bible Swan.
Boyd
Swan.
But, you know, I mean, we're going to eventually get around to talking about the breakfast scene, because I think that it really kind of – it's weird. He barely says anything, but I think that firmly establishes his character as being probably the most complex character.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say Boyd?
Boyd.
Yeah, okay.
Just because of what he's not saying and what he is doing in that scene.
It feels like he's internally – fighting against the morality of his religion and what's happened in war. And it's like he's there and he's not saying anything because he's like, okay, you know, like we can't take advantage of this family. But then at the same time, it's like he wants to join in the looting and everything going on around him. It's like he's almost contemplating that. It's just really interesting. That scene is really interesting because they seem like a family, a typical family. They respect War Daddy. They respect Pitt, and they say, I'm not going to go to war with anyone else. But they're not instantly and immediately obedient. So he tells them, hey, you know, touch her, you're going to deal with me. Hey, chill out. And they kind of push him like a kid pushes their parent. You know, they're kind of and they kind of pout too, because, well, you're up here eating. Why'd you take him instead of us? So I thought there's a very interesting dynamic in that scene. It's a really powerful scene. I think it goes on too long. Yeah.
Wait, did you just turn that scene into like the a prodigal son like
parable? I hope not. I don't know. But it was good because you see in that scene, in that whole town scene, that the good guys can sometimes be the bad guys. And I was telling somebody else, I said, it's easy for us. We're tense. We're like, oh, no, like they need to act morally. They, you know, all these things. But then you think about it, after everything they've done, after killing and whatever, like, of course, they're probably going to go into town and they probably want to get drunk, right? They probably want to get drunk and try to find a way to forget about what's happened. So I think even in those moments when those characters show their flaws, it reveals humanity, and you can even sympathize with them. And that's what Ayers, I feel like he does well, is even in the moments where they're not perfect, you are still sympathetic to these characters.
Mm-hmm. And he does a really good job of that. I think that if this – you know, again, going back to the fact that the movie's about the five of them and their tank, and it's not about this, you know, bigger meta message of war, anti-war, whatever. I think maybe those are the trappings or the leftovers of the movie, but they're not the main thrust of the entire movie.
Well, I like how in the Christianity Today review, there was a line that said, in war, the best chance of saving your life is surrendering your humanity. Because yeah. I feel like that was woven into all these characters, like, their decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, Wade, you were talking about Bible being up there and his performance. At least I think it was Wade, right?
Maybe. Just now?
Yeah, like, and so, like, he didn't have to hardly say anything. He's conflicted with what he can say and what he can't say. And he's almost decided, like, he's come to terms with the fact that he has this religion and he's found a way to make it work with what he's got to do. Mm-hmm. But anytime that you have to be reminded of what you've left behind, it really makes those decisions problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Because it reminds you that you've basically given up your humanity to do this thing.
Yeah.
That you've justified to yourself to do.
And Brad Pitt's character understands that. And there's that scene. It's so harrowing whenever he makes Norman kill that German soldier. And that's kind of what he's saying. He's saying, hey, the reason he did that is because he wants Norman to survive. He wants his group to survive. Mm-hmm. And he knows he's going to have to give up some of that humanity in order to survive. So he's kind of he's practical. His character, War Daddy, is practical, not always moral. And I think that that's what the interesting part of the film is that he's like, okay, he's got to learn to kill, and I'm gonna make him do that. So yeah, there were a lot of interesting ideas just kind of floating around in that scene and the breakfast scene.
Well, with trying to balance the concept that Pitt's character Collier or War Daddy, you know, whichever name he's going by at the time, that he's understanding that you have to sacrifice some of that humanity, but at the same time, he's also compassionate and wanting to bond and save his, you know, fellow soldiers or fellow tank mates. Where do you land on the question of, is it, you know, a war film or an anti-war film, Wade?
I'm in between. I would say I don't think like the first half is pro, second half is anti. I think it's just mixed all the way through. You have these moments where you have these moments when they go into the town and you see the children that have been hung because they didn't fight for the Germans. And clearly at that moment the film is pro war. Like the soldiers, what they are doing is right because of what's occurring here. Like, there mm-hmm. clearly are some bad people on the other side. But then when they go in the town, what do? They're freeing the people in the town, but they're also kind of enslaving them. Like, are they really free? And then that's when it kind of goes into anti-war, and it goes back and forth. And I was reading some reviews, and I think some of the problems that people had is they said, oh, it's kind of reveling in war, and the soldiers are excited to kill the Nazis and those types of things. And I think that misses the point. I don't think that Ayers is saying, hey, yeah, let's kill these soldiers. He's basically pointing out, like, the moral difficulties that come with that. Like, in one sense, you're like, yeah, let's kill the Nazis. Like, they're doing, you know, let's get them. And then in another sense, you're like, am I celebrating people, like, being killed? And mm-hmm. I think he's playing with us there. I think he's pulling back and forth. And to say one or the other, I think, would be a misrepresentation. I think it really is both.
Yeah. It's like watching his inner dialogue go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Because this, like I said, to me, there are elements of this that are pro, like, just war. There are pro, like, anti-war. So I think that if you leave the theater after watching Fury and you've made up your mind, then you weren't watching some part of this movie. Yeah. I think what this movie does best, because I love movies, obviously, you know, we do this podcast, so I love movies that, like, basically force us to have a conversation. They don't let us go, basically be entertained and leave without some kind of emotional or intellectual engagement.
Yeah.
And I think at the end of the day, when you leave this, like, I could, even though I fall more on the anti-violence, the anti-war side of my own personal belief system, like, I'm like, you know what? I felt like I saw a lot of really good arguments for why people, you know, believe in just war.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that people who already believe in just war, and they're usually pretty gung-ho for war films, could be like, you know, maybe this isn't as glamorous and as cut and dry as I've always thought it was. Like, who mm-hmm. who are the bad guys? Mm-hmm. Wait, you know, we believe in a theology that says we're all the bad guys.
Yeah.
So it's really hard. And that was one of the things that really struck me, because there's this great article at Relevant where they interview David Ayers, and he basically says at one point, that's the thing. People are drawn to World War II because it was a contest of good and evil.
Yeah.
It's very black and white. And I'm like, but that's cheating, because he's saying that, but he makes a movie that is not black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
You know what? I think he does make the case, not for war in general, but that World War II was necessary. I think he does make that case. And I probably need to backtrack a little bit on what it is. I think he does make the case that World War II should have happened, and it was a good thing, but not everything that went on there was good. I think he does make that case, especially with the people, the children being hanged. You know, they emphasize the SS and the horrible mm-hmm. things the SS has done. So I do think that he says that, but I don't think he makes the case that every war is okay. So I probably need to backtrack on what I did say a little bit earlier.
So wait, it is a pro war film now?
So it's a pro World War II film, not necessarily pro war in general. Does that make sense?
It does.
Ideals are peaceful, history is violent.
Yeah. I don't think you can walk out and say, well, maybe he's saying that we shouldn't have gone to World War II and just let the Germans take over Europe. I don't think I can walk out of the film saying that. But I will say this. What a lot of films and art can do is they can synonymously link the morality of a war to its participants. And so what you see with a lot of World War II films is they create these demigods of the soldiers. All the soldiers were good. They were freedom fighters. When you look at movies for Vietnam, well, the war, of course, didn't go well. A lot of people believe we shouldn't have been over there. And so you have this huge emphasis on some of the terrible things that the soldiers did. And what this film did is it, I think it says, hey, World War II, we should have been over there, but not everybody was perfect. And there's an interesting balance in that.
So did either of you, we kind of talked about our expectations going into this movie, and I certainly had some, but I never thought that it would be so on the nose. You know, like, Faith was thrown right out there. I imagine, well, we're dealing with, you know, war. We're going to be obviously talking about redemptive violence, the, you know, concept of just war and things like that, a brotherhood, you know, being willing to lay down your life. Because, you know, it's a war movie, so someone was going to sacrifice themselves for somebody. So I knew there was going to be themes that we could talk about, but I didn't expect to have a character who basically came out and was quoting scripture. Did that kind of take either of you guys?
Especially like, Shia LaBeouf, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it didn't take me by. It would have taken me by surprise if maybe I'd went into the movie not knowing that, because I actually didn't know really anything until I made the terrible mistake of liking Fury on Facebook, and then it started like, you know, having stuff about the movie every day, and then they had like they had a little graphic of you know, Shia LaBeouf and like him saying like something about God, and I was like, well, wait a minute, what did I just look at? And you scroll back down, and you're like, oh. Weird. I didn't know he was in that movie. His name is Bible in the movie. Why is Shia LaBeouf quoting Bible verses in Fury? And you kind of expect it, but it almost is taken aback. You know, that what I guess I was taken aback by was the amount of dialogue about those things in the movie, and then the complexity of his character. I was surprised. I shouldn't be so surprised after reading, you know, some of the interviews with Ayer, you know, and, you know, apparently he does confess himself to be a Christian, and to like be a Bible believing Christian. So it's kind of like, oh, you know, it makes sense that it's in the movie, but it was definitely surprising. And then, you know, some of the amusing dialogue and then some of the serious dialogue was centered around, you know, Bible's beliefs and, you know, how he was able to justify being there. You know, like there's that when they're driving just in the tanks, you know, to whatever mission they're going to, and, you know, they're bantering back and forth about his faith and like, you know, is Hitler in heaven?
Yeah.
And, you know, he was like, I've told you before what I believe about that. And, you know, then it got a little crass and
yeah. I mean, it was tongue in cheek, but yeah, they're still having a question that I think a lot of people are too afraid to really to talk about, especially when they get down to the brass tacks of like what they say they believe. I mean, like, how do you deal with Hitler in the concept of all encompassing redemptive grace?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hitler, you know, like, said he was a Christian.
Yeah. What would it take to get Hitler to heaven? You know?
Yeah. So. It's crazy because there's so many things. I came into the movie. I didn't know that Shia LaBeouf was going to play a Christian. I actually came in worried that he would be too distracting in the film, just him and his character. But he pulled it off. I mean, it was great. It's really crazy because he says, you know, here I am, send me. He believes that God has his hand of divine protection on them specifically, even though there are people dying all around them. He says he's on a special mission, you know, to kill Nazis. And so I look at that aspect of his faith and I say, okay, he's a little misguided. But then, okay, then when they're looting, he's sitting there reading his Bible. He's not he thinks it's his mission to kill Nazis, but he's not going to comment on Hitler's soul, which was really fascinating. And then they shoot Nazis and he jumps out and he tries to pray the sinner's prayer with them before they die. And I thought that was,
man, yeah, I totally forgot about that part.
I thought that was a really great part. He plays the moral sinner. So, I don't agree with necessarily, Shia LaBeouf's theology of war in the film.
Yeah.
But his character was just so, I felt like it was so well put together and it made for some great conversation. That's one of the reasons why I love the film so much. If you take out his character, I'm not going to give it you know, 4.5 stars.
There would definitely be a huge void. But then again, that's what, like I said, again, this relevant article is relevant article. The hell relevant is that? This article with that interview with him anyway, because it seems like his central question in making the movie, at least as far as we can believe him espousing what he meant to do, was trying to explore how someone can lean on their faith in Christ when faced with such inhumanity and destruction. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think when you're put in a situation like that, it's really hard for me to believe that your faith is going to be consistent.
Yeah, well, think about it. I mean, like, you know, the whole idea of ideals are peaceful, history is violent. You know, the reasons of war, they might be noble, but like the fighting on the ground is horrible, and it'll crush you as a person in those situations. And, you know, it's really this exploration of finding redemption in the midst of being crushed, you know, finding morality in the midst of like an amoral, you know, sort of zone, or be, you know, finding humanity in the midst of inhumanity amongst violence and war. And I think that's what Shia LaBeouf's character so does such a great job of being able to convey, both in what he says and then some of the things that he doesn't say. Like, I know, Wade, and you and I like interacted, and then we were shut down by Fizz so that we couldn't talk about the movie anymore on Letterboxd. But, you know, I think we were bringing up the idea that he must have maybe like way back when they were fighting a long time ago, just in that breakfast scene when he's just sitting there, you know, and like a tear comes down from it, you know, goes down his eye when they're talking about this sort of dichotomy of War Daddy's trying to find this little peaceful nook in the midst of the war, and, mm-hmm. you know, all of them who have been through hell. You know, you almost get this tension that he's experienced some of the things that Logan Lerman's character Norman is experiencing in the movie itself. Like, he's gone through, you know, having to basically lose some of his humanity, and he's trying to keep some of his humanity, you know, through his faith.
Mm-hmm. And we see the opposite of that in Brad Pitt's character. What I loved so much is at the end, he begins to quote scripture, Brad Pitt. I mean, he has sections memorized. Yeah. And so it's almost as if they're saying he was a pastor, or he was a part of a church, or he was a Christian, and war basically exterminated his faith. And so you have mm-hmm. Shia LaBeouf's character, and he's like, hey, God put me here. God, you know, he leans on his faith. Brad Pitt goes in the opposite direction and basically says, like, you know, God doesn't care. Is there a God? If there is a God, why are all these things happening? And that was a powerful point, to have these two characters who seem to start from the same place probably, and they go in two different directions. And I loved what Ayers did with that.
Well, that's the thing. When I think about Collier or Brad Pitt's character, and I think about Norman, I actually see them, from where we're introduced to both those characters, them both going in opposite directions. Because I think by the end of the film, I think Collier has regained some of his humanity, which is why, you know, they decide to, you know, stay at the crossroad and do the thing and sacrifice themselves if need be. Mm-hmm. Whereas normal Norman, just the, you know, your average Joe guy, but by the time he has his humanity ripped from him, when his awkwardly new love, Emma, is conveniently found dead in the rubble. and you know, he's got this piece of humanity stripped from him. They start referring to him as the machine. Mm-hmm. Like, that's his new nickname. So he goes from the guy who will rather die than kill a prisoner of war to being known as machine for basically, you know, having nerves of steel at the right moment. And so by the end of the film, I think just the look on Norman's face when he's walking away at the end, just, it's still this cold look, like
when he's in that truck and they're pulling him away from the tank. Yeah.
That, I mean, he's still cold. I mean, he's experienced something. I mean, obviously, like I said, we're spoiling the movie. He's experienced grace to some degree. He's had the enemy basically spare his life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The evil, the Nazi, has spared his life. The black in the black and white has suddenly become white and grayed the entire, you know, the entire outcome of the movie. But he's had this experience, and it does, he seems to have maybe affected him, but he's still got those, like, that stone cold look. Whereas, like I said, at the end, up to the point where he's sacrificing himself, you know, Collier is basically, he's been changed by Norman. He's been reminded of his humanity.
Yeah.
And he realizes there, you know, surviving isn't the only thing that is necessary. Hmm. And
this ultimately
lives that out. Yeah.
This is a spoiler cast, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Spoiler. Okay, so we can, yeah.
I was trying to hold it off until we needed to, but
this,
like,
this movie is spoiled rotten.
Yeah.
As of right now.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like there's any sense of, like, triumphalism of war that you can get with some other movies. Like, even Vietnam War movies can sometimes have more triumphalism than this movie had. As far as, you know, like, because, you know, there's, like, when they pick him up and they rescue him, the Allied soldiers, like, somebody kind of, like, off screen says, oh, you're a hero. And but you get no feeling whatsoever that he feels, or even the movie feels, like he's a hero.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I agree.
Yeah, because this movie, like I said, it takes a lot of the same exact paces. Like, I knew, you know, even one of the reviews I read was like, I could tell you the order in which all the characters were going to die. I could tell you who was going to live and who was going to make it and what the decisions were going to be. But I think the outcome is what makes this so different, because you have something very similar happen in Saving Private Ryan. You know, they get to this thing, they came there for Ryan, but then once they get there, they're like, oh, well, all we need is Ryan. Well, we're looking out for the greater good. We're willing to all stay and be outmanned and sacrifice ourselves for this bridge. And we're probably all going to die. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happens. You know, they're like, our tank is disabled. We're at this place. If they get through, they're going to kill lots of doctors and wounded people. So we need to make this decision, and most of them die. Mm-hmm. The problem is, at the end of Saving Private Ryan, there's a victory. There's like we did something good and noble, and it was the right decision, and we all feel really great about it because we were the moral good. And at the end of Fury, it's like they did the exact same thing. Most of them sacrificed their lives. But the person who came out of it, even when he's called a hero, he has this blank stare, like, I'm still not sure that it was worth it, basically.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And that final shot expresses the duality of the war. Because in one sense, you're zooming out and you're like, wow, look what they did. Like, they stopped all those SS soldiers. But then in another sense, you're like, wow, look what they did. So I feel like that shot, it did such a good job of just of living in the tension and the ambiguity of this film. And I, when the shot ended, I remember thinking, this is a special type of film. And what you said, Fizz, was right on.
Do you think that the movie would have had more impact if Norman had died?
I feel like it would have been more realistic. But the fact that a German soldier, an SS soldier, the baddest of the baddest, saved him, helped to kind of further reinforce the line between good guy and bad guy. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it might have been – so it's like logic says yes, or logic says he should have died. Your emotions in your heart says, I'm glad that he lived.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I'm glad that he lived.
Yeah, and that to me is the difference in this film, and like the things that keep it from being like a perfect film for me are the conveniences necessary in this narrative to get the characters where we need them to explore the themes and make the points that I think Ayer is trying to make.
Yeah.
And it's not just one time. If it was one time, I think I could forgive it.
Yeah.
But even though, like you're saying, my heart wants certain things to happen, I think it would be more honest if other things happen. I mean, because, you know, I've already mentioned this once, but, you know, so he's Norman falls in love, I guess. Well, you know, we're made to believe that he does. There is definitely an attraction there. There's definitely a connection to some degree with Emma, this, you know, this German girl that he beds. And immediately after that happens, after that connection's made, like, there is a shelling and, you know, her building collapses and he is... Not only does her building collapse, not only does she die, but he is instantly able to find her in the rubble.
Yeah, and out of all the gruesomeness of war, it's like her body is so clean.
Yeah,
like it looks like someone just punched her in the nose.
yeah. No, I that was a little too convenient, and I saw what they're trying to do there. They're trying to push him to machine.
Yeah.
But it was just it was a little too on the nose for me.
Yeah.
So you have a movie that takes place like in roughly like a day or so. So you kind of have to speed up some of those things. So you have two convenient moments that get the character where we need to get him to, like I said, really truly explore the theme. So I almost don't want to fault the movie for that. But then again, like I said, you also have the scene at the end where, you know, he's under the tank. We think, oh man, he's going to sneak away. And I'm like, well, is no one really going to check underneath the tank? Like, they're SS soldiers. They're probably like, look under the tank, you know, like yeah. They probably have a little pamphlet. When you encounter a tank, look under the tank.
Yeah.
Except it's in German. So it's probably like, Zinken the tank.
Make sure to look under the tank.
That's right.
Thank you.
Oh man. We're preparing tank puns for this. I forgot. I forgot to armor myself against those puns.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Sure, man. Really whatever. Different.
Oh,
I'm just shell shocked right now, guys.
Oh, I feel like, well, never mind. I'm gonna try to stop it. So there's also that
in your tracks.
Oh my gosh. you go get him, Tiger. I don't know.
Oh no.
So the scene at the end where the German soldier basically, you know, lets him go. Like I said, that does seem all too convenient too, but. Like you know, like you pointed out, my heart wanted him to live because I feel like there needs to be someone to tell the story, kind of.
Yeah.
And so I want the storyteller to live, so I feel that we experienced a journey with him, because if he doesn't live, then there can't be a lesson basically learned. And since he's basically our in to the story,
mm-hmm.
I feel like we would miss the lesson if he died,
mm-hmm.
To some degree.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I also, we haven't gotten into much of the technical aspects, I guess, in some ways. I loved the action sequences with the tanks. Mm-hmm. I thought those were fantastic. They were intense. And I really loved what they did with the tracer rounds. I don't know if I've actually seen that in a film.
No one, like, really explain it?
I felt like the way they portrayed those tracer rounds, where they kind of look like lasers, I liked the look of that. I thought that was – it made it a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I've seen it like that in a film. But at the same time, the grenades exploded into fire, and that doesn't happen.
No.
So not that I explode grenades often, yeah.
I was going to say, the reason I haven't really talked about the technical aspects of it are because most of that stuff is going to fall into my favorite / come on stuff.
Oh, okay.
So I was saving it a little bit, and I do want to get back to it.
Okay, we'll hold off then.
But so one last thing that I wanted to mention before we move into that, because we have surprisingly knocked out a whole bunch of time already, is... The internet was a flutter with these stories of Shia LaBeouf having a conversion experience from doing Fury. You know, he say, I found God doing Fury. I became a Christian man, and not just in a BS way, in a very real way. And he obviously says the word. And I almost wanted to get you guys' reaction to him saying that he had a conversion experience, but also your reaction to the Christian backlash that is judging the goodness or badness of his claim.
Mm-hmm. Wade, you can go first. I know that. I know that you actually talked about this already over at Christ in Pop Culture.
Yeah, we talked about this on the podcast. You know, there are a couple thoughts that come to mind. I think the first thing that I felt was cynicism, because he's kind of he's a strange guy, to say the least, right?
He
says he's a method actor. So you wonder if this is legitimate or if he is just attempting to become the character. So I was a little cynical, but at the same time, I didn't appreciate the articles that said, hey, he's a method actor, he did not become a Christian. I think we have to be careful with saying that. I don't know. I lean kind of towards cynicism, but at the same time, as a Christian, I feel like it's hard to be like, you know what, that guy didn't become a Christian. For the backlash, I saw as much good as I did bad. I did see a lot of good, people who were excited about it. I feel like I saw two extremes. People who were like, yes, this is awesome, he became a Christian, this is great. And then the people who were like, nah, he's cussing, he's not a Christian. Right? Well, if you think that this guy, he just became a new Christian, like, of course his attitudes or his thoughts or his words aren't going to necessarily line up with someone who grew up in church, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not a huge issue for me. We did talk about it on the podcast, and one of the points that was made was, we don't need to give him a microphone right now, right? He doesn't need to get on the stage and give his testimony. Yeah. We need to for us, I mean, really all we can do is pray for him, right? Mm-hmm. For those that are around him who are Christians, like, disciple him and give him some time and let him grow in his faith. Don't put him on television. Don't give him a microphone. I think we kind of have to find this middle ground. I do feel a little uncomfortable, as I said before, though, with saying he didn't become a Christian. Now, it might be that he didn't, but I'm weary of saying that. So, Josh, now it's your turn.
Yep.
You're like, he did not become a Christian. No, do you agree? Do you disagree?
When these things tend to happen, because apparently, according to this article that Fizz sent us, the conversions of public people are legion. And man, I usually just close my ears to this kind of stuff. Because, I mean, how would you feel if you were not a Christian, which I wasn't when I was 19 and I, you know, started walking with Jesus? If somebody like thrust a microphone in front of your face and was like, you know, you're a believer now, tell us all this really important stuff about being a Christian. And I'd be like, he's really great.
Give us a full nuanced theology of your faith.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I just like, I think that's both it's the paradox and the, beauty, but also something that people will see from the outside as being strange about the Christian faith is that, you know, you don't have to list off like a certain like group of things, you know, that you've completed in order to be where you're at. And like the simple walk of being a disciple of Christ, like the journey of being a disciple of Christ, and here's like the pastor coming like straight out of me, you know, the walk of being a disciple of Christ is not a journey that you necessarily, you know, are starting when you're a fully formed, you know, theologian in the faith. You know, I mean, gosh, I just even think of like my mom isn't a celebrity, but you know, when she first like said, you know, like we're going to church and like I'm a Christian and, you know, I got to baptize her, like she's not a perfect Christian to this day. and she makes a lot of the same mistakes that moms make, you know, and a lot of annoying things that I'm like, wow, that wasn't very Christian, you know, that wasn't very much walking like Christ. But, you know, like I trust that God is working in her heart, and I know that the Spirit's working in her, and I kind of feel the same way about this whole thing. Like, that's, you know, it kind of at the end of the day, I end up thinking that's fantastic, and we're praying for him. But to either be like he is or he isn't is a really, really bad debate to get into. Mm-hmm. You know, it, you know, Fizz, just like in the article you said, like the this person who wrote it ends with like, we don't know if he's a Christian or not, but they basically spent paragraph after paragraph going, you know, Paul said in Corinthians, you know, those who are influential and powerful on earth aren't going to come to Christ and all this other stuff. And it's like, geez, you seem to have really skewed opinion about this. And, you know, like citing examples of like Charlie Sheen and like all these people who, you know, once they profess Christ and then they appear to change their tune once their popularity reaches critical mass, it's just like, yeesh. Like, I mean, it's a tough fence to walk along, and maybe it's not even something that a line that you really even need to like try and balance on. And we can just be like, that's fantastic, and let's let him be one if he's going to be one, you know?
Yeah, and I would say that when I read it, I instantly had some levels of cynicism. I think, you know, we all to a certain degree have admitted that we have some levels of some cynicism, some doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But what, because I think honestly, and what the article that I did link pointed out, and where I could agree with it kind of, is that I think that if you take a lot of what the Bible says about like who's going to get into heaven and who's not, like I think the rich man, it could be translated to like the Hollywood actor or the, you know, the person in the business. You know, there's you can get a camel through the eye of a needle faster than you can get someone in Hollywood like as a true Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that. But ultimately, I'm hoping it's not going to matter. And I will hopefully have my hope, I use the word hope a lot, in the fact that I disagree with Penn Jillette, who basically argues that all you need to do to become an atheist is read the Bible or the Torah or the Quran or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that most people, if you really take a good look at Scripture, then you will probably come out a changed person.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you actually end up believing in, like, you know, become a believer or not, I think it will change how you think about the world, in a positive way, not like not becoming an atheist. And I hope that most people kind of avoid having that older brother syndrome. And when someone does come to the flock, we don't say, well, that's crazy because they do all this other thing, or they were dumb for a long time, or I disagreed with everything they did for a long time, and we just be able to embrace them and say, that's great. And I would hope we do what you're saying, Wade. I mean, we have to realize that ultimately, like, all we can really do is pray for them and hope that there is somebody in his life who's helping disciple him and walking along the way with him. If, you know, if he is serious about it and it's not just some kind of byproduct of method acting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I hope it, I sit and I hope that it's true, and that, you know, he's found Christ, but if not, I'm not going to spend lots of time getting mad about it. So.
Yeah. Or, you know, cancel your fan club membership.
Yeah. To the my LaBeef membership.
My Even Stevens fan club membership.
Oh, yes, geez. Right. See, and I think the interesting thing is what there, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, it seems like forever ago because it's before I had kids. I was working as a camp counselor, and I had this kid, one of my campers come up to me, and he's like, are the White Stripes a Christian band? And I was like, you know, I don't think so, you know, he does have a lot of things that he says that are Christian-y in his music, but I don't think he is. And the guy, he was really, really upset about that, because I think that he was coming from the place that, like, oh, now I can't tell my mom that Jack White's a Christian. So I can't listen to the White Stripes anymore. And, you know, I think, like, the opposite side is, you know, a lot of people will take, like, oh, this profession of faith, you know, is like, oh, man, now I feel a little bit better about him, and I feel a little bit better about watching him in those terrible Transformer movies. And I feel great about, you know, his work in the future. And I think that's – I don't see that in the circles that I run in. I don't people, you know, like, someone hasn't come up to me and been like, hey, man, did you hear about Shia LaBeouf? This is awesome. You know, like, but, you know, I think that there's legitimately people out there that need to be taken off of the other side of the ledge, which is, you know, like, we can take this as, like, you know, now we're okay with, now he's okay. He's another safe place to go to in Hollywood. And
this is Christ taking back Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly.
We have another warrior, you know, fighting for Christ.
And I, you know, I remember, I think I told that camper, like, you know, you don't, he doesn't need to be a Christian for you to enjoy this, you know, the White Stripes, you know.
Whoa, what kind of bad advice is this? do you even go to church? Like, what's wrong with you, man?
I'm sorry. I'm gonna have to turn in my badge.
Wait, you get a badge? Where's this badge?
Sorry, man, you're not in the club.
Oh, yeah. Man.
You were never there, so you can't lose it, right?
Wow.
Yeah. Wait, what are we talking about?
Burn. Roasted. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's really, yes, Wade, let's just pray for him.
Yeah. I mean, really, you can't do anything else.
Yeah. And let's see how his next movie goes.
If it's a good movie, then we'll know he's a Christian.
Right. Maybe he'll be Daniel Radcliffe and he'll play the devil in his next movie.
We're like, oh, we see what you did there.
I could see him playing one of Jesus's disciples. Mm. You know?
He's got a, let's see.
Judas. Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think so. I think he's got like a...
He's got like a Peter, you know? Kind of brass. Yeah. I think he could play a Peter.
He's got a nice voice for Peter.
Yeah. Huh. You can only dream, huh?
Man, now I really want to figure this out.
Yeah, now we've really derailed our Fury conversation.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, okay, so, but that was awesome. That's exactly what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to just kind of have those discussions to make sure that, you know, we were thinking a little more meta and the implications of a movie, because the concept of this movie is that it's affecting and changing culture. And one of the things that is done through this movie, even though it was not something that you saw on the screen, is it's still affecting culture from the waves that it's making. Mm. And so I still think that's worth discussing as well. But to get back to the movie, let's kind of start wrapping it up and talking about, and we kind of mentioned this already, but some of our come on moments, like some of those things that just didn't sit right with us. Even though we've all said that we really like this movie a lot, there obviously were things that prevented it from being just a perfect movie. So, Josh, what were some of the things that just made you scratch your head, or you made you say, come on?
Well, I'll only do one and see where it goes from there. But, you know, there's five guys in a tank stuck at a crossroads facing off against like 200 to 300 German soldiers. At what point did the Germans decide to be like, let's stop running right at the tank and getting mowed over and figure something else out?
Interesting.
Like at what point couldn't they be like, okay, we can stand behind the farmhouse and fire rockets at it?
Well, they did. Did they have the rockets?
Well, they had some. Oh my gosh, what are they called?
They had some smaller stuff, a little bit into the fight, I believe.
Yeah, I mean they had some Panzerstrecks, but.
Ooh,
what are those?
Deep cut, knowing what those are called.
What are the? Oh, what's the other? It's like Strum Guards. Oh, there's a. They're like Grenadier. Mm-hmm. groups. They had a couple of those guys, and they were obviously trying to like use the infantry to kind of distract so those guys could get in position.
Okay.
But it looked like they were really ready for them. I don't necessarily, I mean, I would think it could be a legitimate strategy. I don't know enough about war strategy, but they, it could be a decent strategy to basically bum rush a tank. Cause all you typically need to do is get on the tank, but they, you know, they obviously have lots of grenades and stuff. They toss out the side and keep people off the tank. They do a pretty good job of that. And, you know, there's a, I think there's a, an implied arrogance to being in the SS that you assume that, you know, you can just basically walk over everybody else. And I think they were in a pretty bad position when the fight started. So at that point, you just kind of hope your numbers can out.
Yeah, and you don't know how many shells that they have.
Yeah.
They do run out, but you don't know, you know, how many they have or what they're doing. Yeah, I mean, we see both sides. So I think maybe that could kind of explain it a little bit. But I think your point is valid, Josh.
I do think it was a little... It was a little unbelievable for them to have killed that many without taking more damage or to have died sooner.
And it all goes back, I feel like, to the logic versus emotion. Mm-hmm. Logically, you're like, eh. Emotionally, you're like, I mean, they are making this stand. They are mowing these Nazis down. So it's kind of this logic-emotion balance.
Yeah, and there's no point I didn't think that during the movie. During the movie, I'm like, oh, man, this is intense. You know, but after the movie, it's kind of like, you know, at what point was the third or fourth wave? They were like, I don't think I'm going to run.
Excuse me, Commander. Actually, that's probably not German accent at all.
Is there any way we could do something different? No, keep going.
Question.
Ask questions.
So I would say this though, something that I would think it's totally valid is if they had a sniper, like why he needed to crawl up like 10 feet away from the tank before he would have like a good shot to take that out. Like I think that he could have been way, way far back and even in the dark because there was so much light from the fires and stuff. If he was going to be able to take the shot at 15 feet, he would have been able to take the shot at, you know, 100 yards. There are things like that did trouble me. And ultimately, if we didn't have this mass carnage, that scene, that shot that, Wade, you were talking about when you know, the camera starts panning away that final shot, I don't think would have been near as like impactful if we didn't have that kind of destruction.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But point made, Josh, we both agree with you in our disagreeing kind of explaining ways.
We agree, but we don't want to agree with you.
Yeah, we don't want to.
And they might have just cut the scene where they were greasing up the tank before the attack. So the guys just kept comically slipping off instead of being able to get up to the top.
That would be great.
They had, like, Macaulay Culkin was in the tank, like, right before. Yeah. Marbles and micro machines.
Joe Pesci is the commander of the SS.
Yes.
This could almost be a like a College Humor video at this point. I think
let's rein it in, people. Rein it in.
Well, you're so good at keeping us on topic, Josh.
I am terrible at that.
Well, Wade, what was your gripe?
Well, we mentioned one was the girl when she died. I was like, okay, you know, a little much. I think one of the biggest moments though was when they are. Right before they make they're making the heroic stand. They're deciding whether they should do it, and you know, it's like this kind of movie moment, this filmatic, cinematic war movie moment where it's like, well, we have to make a stand to save all these other people. And I felt like they just kind of like raised everything up. When they, instead of giving them a battalion of regular German soldiers, they were all SS soldiers. Like, so instead of making it, hey, these are just some Germans attacking, they're like, these are the SS. And I felt like they were trying too hard to make the situation more heroic than it already was. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, it's just not, you know, our enemy. It's like the worst of the worst. So I remember when I was watching the movie, I was like, okay. Like, I get it. Like, it's a little much, though.
I can see that. But it was part of that convenient narrative that we've already talked about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it goes into that. If it was just a normal, like, cause this is staged as late in the war, right? So this is 45. This is when most of the German army is like young boys and older men. You know, most of the of age soldiers have already died trying to defend the advancements of the Allied armies. So if there was a normal army, they might not even be worried that it would go and try to hit this camp. Yeah. It would be like, well, they're just here defending. But since it's the SS, we can assume that the SS, not just being Nazis, but being the bad, bad Nazis, that they would go and they would murder doctors and nurses and, you know, injured people.
Yeah.
So I felt like it was pretty convenient, you know, but more so like for the exact same reasons that like, my come on moment is the thing that you mentioned too, that when Emma died, you know, she's just sitting there. How convenient that her building just happened to be bombed. All the buildings that stand from that bombing, hers just happened to be, and not just like her building, but like particular where she was in this huge building, you know, and then she's just laying on top of her like an angel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I mean, basically saying like she was an innocent, just in case you didn't get that. This is an innocent, you know, what if she was pregnant too? They should have played that in there. You know?
Oh no. somehow she just knew.
You killed
you knew.
Within an hour. That's the fastest pregnancy test.
You killed my only love and my baby.
And my baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, okay, so like I said, we always want to end on a high note, so let's talk favorite moments. So Josh, what were your favorite moments from this movie?
Oh man, I'm gonna steal it. I'm gonna steal the fight against the tiger tank, because that is just an intense sequence that is so so good, and it's oh man, it like I don't I like you said earlier, I don't think that there's a lot of movies that have a lot of action-y tank scenes in them, and it was so well done. I mean, there's not
any recent ones.
Yeah, well, yeah, and there's not a huge sample size to go off of, but it felt as compelling as if like you were playing Call of Duty, you know, but better and more intense.
Because I would say that when I left the theater, Laura kind of asked me, like, is that how it really was? Like, were their tanks that much better? I was like, they were so much better that it's almost fictional that three Shermans were able to beat this tank.
Wow. Yeah.
And I mean, truthfully, it was only because they got a lucky shot off.
Yeah. I mean, they, and even then it's lucky that when they got hit, they just happened to have like the logs that helped deflect the thing, like that, their tank should have been destroyed too. It's the best tank battles that I think I've seen, since like the Desert Fox, like a 1951 movie about Rommel. You know, like you just don't get a lot of great tank battles that aren't really gimmicky. So,
Or just sort of, you know, background dressing in the movie.
I mean, because even the tank stuff you get in, like Band of Brothers, which is, I think, pretty decent. It's not really, you know, it's never focused on the tanks, and it's like, oh, this tank blew up. Okay. You know, like you never get a lot of the actual tank strategy, tank battle kind of stuff going on. It's just they're there as something that accompanies the infantry, and usually the infantry is the focus. So, or there's something to be blown up by like airplanes when you get like a fighter movie or something like that.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, I agree.
So Wade, what did you?
I don't know. I mean, I love that sequence that Josh mentioned. I really did love the end. In terms of like just the favorite thing about the movie, I guess, is I love the way that they included religion into this film, because I mean, if you have a World War II movie, religion is going to be an issue. And instead of kind of just maybe just not including it or pushing it out of the narrative. Like religion, Christianity, faith took in some ways a center stage, and I like how they did that through Shia LaBeouf's character, and so that's what really did it for me. That's what put this movie over the top is those themes of religion and faith. And divine protection, or you know, this divine call that Bible seems to think he has, and so I think that was probably my favorite aspect of the film. But I mean, there are a lot of good things to choose from.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like how between the two of you, you've more or less, maybe not specifically, taken my favorite two things from this film.
Oh,
and because one was then that's fine because I think it's cool that we all resonate with the same things.
Yeah.
The Tiger Tank battle was amazing. Mm-hmm. I see so few good tank battles that it was really cool to watch them fire and like have shells ricochet. And then they had the filmmaking presence to like see, we saw the ricochet fly off.
Mm-hmm.
Like miles in the distance, because most of the tank battles that I think I see, a tank fires and if it misses, it just blows up a big piece of the ground or it hits a building. Mm-hmm. You know, like in this one, we saw tanks shooting at each other, and when they miss, like if it ricocheted off armor and stuff, it just kept going. Or there was one where they shoot and it like they shot at such a low angle, it actually ricocheted off the ground and went back up in the air.
Yeah, yeah.
Off into the distance. And I was like, I've just never seen anyone do that before. I mean, I've seen them do it with like bullets and, you know, other kinds of things, but never in like in a tank battle. And maybe that was just, it was great. But the tank battle itself, it was tense. You kind of had a feel that they were obviously weren't going to lose, but these other tanks that you'd kind of come along with, you're like, they're not going to kill all of these guys, right? And all those guys died,
nope.
You know, and in very in glamorous ways.
Mm.
And I think that's it's like watching movies about bombers, you know, and like you'd get a fix to a crew and the death rate of bomber pilots and crew was extremely high.
Mm.
And you'd be like, well, they all died. You know, their plane shot down. When your plane shot down, you know, it's thanks.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like when you're in a tank, if you get hit, like you're in a big metal can, you're not going anywhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that reality of the tank battle. But probably my favorite thing in this movie was Shia LaBeouf. I don't know if it's because I have such low expectations or the only thing I was worried about going into this movie was him ruining the movie for me.
Yeah.
But I not only think that he stepped up to the challenge, he, to me, was the best actor in this film.
Hmm.
I really liked what Pitt did, because lots of people compared Pitt to basically just like the same character he played in Glorious Bastards, and I think that does a real disservice.
Yeah, he's very dumb.
What Pitt brought to the role in this, because he wasn't like a character. Like in Glorious Bastards, he's kind of like a character.
Yeah.
And this one, he is like that father, that conflicted soldier. But like, if I right now had to like put in a ballot for best supporting actor, like he would win hands down from like the 60 or so movies that I've seen this year. He is the best supporting actor performance that I've seen.
Wow. Wow. But I haven't thought about that very much. I don't know.
And I think it was so good that I think because, you know, there's not a lot of stuff that I would say is for certain in how I would probably vote for Academy Award nominations and stuff, because I know a lot of that's going to change for the rest of November and December when we get all the, you know, the heavy hitters.
Yeah.
But I thought his performance was so good that I think he at least will be nominated. We've had conspiracy theories about how the Academy works and if he'll win. But like I said, that's how impactful his performance was to me personally.
I thought it was good. I don't think that they'll nominate him.
Oh, no. They, no way.
No, I don't think they're. I don't think he's going to get a nomination. Mm-mm. No.
Oh, man.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I think they'll have some. I think other people will gobble that up.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll take up those nominations.
I'll be interested to see. Maybe it'll be one of those things where he's nominated for a Golden Globe but not an Oscar.
I liked the role. I thought it was great. I thought he did probably the best that he could do. I just don't know if it was glamorous enough or emotional enough for the Academy with the right type of film. I don't know if – so, yeah. I mean, I guess we'll
Maybe
see.
Maybe like a Kids' Choice Award.
he'll get slimed.
Oh, I see what you're doing, Wade. You're just big Hollywood oppressing a Christian for his belief. I see how it is.
Alone, I see how it is. But not alone.
I can't wait because the thing. Well, this is going to lead into final thoughts. But so I want to get your final thoughts on this movie. This is a chance. Anything that we missed? Anything that you want to say? / recommendations? You know, like, well, how would you leave people like the last word of this movie?
Oh,
I don't
man,
care which one of you guys starts first.
Well, no, I think right now I have it at number 7 of my best films of the year or favorite films of the year. So I really did love this film. I think it's a good look at war. If you have a chance, there's a small film. It's on Netflix. It's called Saints and Soldiers. And they deal with some of the same issues in the sense of who are the good guys, who are the bad guys, are the Germans really, are they all bad? So if you like films, it's a smaller film, it's not a big budget, I would check that one out. But I guess just to reflect what I've already said, that I think it's great. I failed to mention Pitt was one of my favorite parts of the film. He's such a good actor, and it's brutal. So it is very brutal. I know it's not going to be for everybody. But I really enjoy this film and I recommend it very, very much so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same thing. It's ditto. This is the second straight Brad Pitt movie that I've done on the podcast. And, once again, Brad Pitt is fantastic in this movie and it's just another really good, deep, thoughtful movie. I was not expecting it to be nearly as deep or as thought-provoking as – I didn't think that we'd be able to talk about it as long as we have been. It's got so many different elements going on. Like Wade, like you said, it really plays with this idea of anti-war and pro-war. And I think it's a very accurate picture. Probably – like I've never been in war. I don't ever plan on it. At least I hope not. But I can imagine that this is what war has got to be like for so many people. It's this tug between humanity and inhumanity, between morality and amorality. And it's so much more thoughtful than I thought it was going to be. And I mean, really, it's a really entertaining movie too. This isn't just, you know, oh man, this movie's really deep, but it's kind of boring. No, it's really exciting.
Yeah.
And it's over 2 hours long, and it did not feel like it was over 2 hours long.
It was over 2 hours long. I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. And you know, when you're done, you know, you feel like you went 12 rounds with like Mike Tyson or something.
Or
and
Hitler.
It's just, yeah. Oh, what? was he a known pugilist?
No, but he's the personification of evil. So
that's true. That is true. But you know, I mean, highly, highly recommend this movie. And it's definitely like I'd watch it again when it comes out, or if it ever ends up on Netflix. Like I'll watch it again because it's that good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, no, I will too.
So this movie for me, I mean, it's not the best movie that I've seen all year, but I feel like, to me, it's really similar and timely that we review this movie right after we did Gone, or very soon after we did Gone Girl, because my recommendation and what I take away from these films is very similar. I really, really like this film. I would highly recommend it on a lot of levels, though I would kind of caveat it with say it's not really for the faint of heart. And, you know, if you obviously shy away from like excessive violence or excessive language or anything like that, it might be it will be too rough for you.
Does that say something about the three of us that we barely mention the fact that this movie is extremely gory?
Well, and I think that's very interesting too, because I mean there's lots of conversations out there, and I think I think Christ of Pop Culture did a, I don't know, I can't remember if you were on it, Wade, but y'all had to, when John Piper put out his stuff about what you can and can't watch as a Christian or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
There's lots of discussions about to be had about us watching and intaking violence, and especially not thoughtful violence.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Versus like nudity or language and the things that we consume. And I think it does probably say something about us, but at the same time, I don't feel that I've been convicted not to watch lots of violence. I don't have a problem, you know, like distinguishing reality. This is one of the things that Josh and I talked about before the podcast. It's really ironic to me. Lots of anti-violent Christian reviewers like say, I don't understand why Christians watch war films or why anyone watches war films, because it basically just tells us to be violent. Or you have to really enjoy violence, or you have to enjoy war or be pro-war to watch war films. And I am very anti-war, but I love war films because there's so much else there. So,
yeah, well, I mean, if there wasn't a lot of gore, would it really be a depiction, a proper depiction of war? I mean, it gets to the point when you think of stories about Jesus. If you have paper cut Jesus all the time, mm-hmm. does it really emphasize the sacrifice that he's made? And that's not to say every movie has to be Passion of the Christ when it's about Jesus. But I think I give some more lenience to war films. And I don't think that this is like exalting violence. I think it's like saying, hey, this is what's happening. Yeah. And for us, we're not cheering when you know people are being killed or decapitated. Mm-hmm. I think we're saying, wow, like, this is, man, war is not fun. So I can give this film lenience on violence.
Yeah. And like I said, I would not just say, hey, yeah, go take your kids. It's a great, you know, I think it is a great movie, but I don't, you know, I think there needs to be some reservation, and I wouldn't change a thing about it. I think there was this great quote to end the Christianity Today review of it. It said, to have a war movie that was rated G would be to lie about what war was. Mm-hmm. I can understand those who would elect not to see it. What I would have a harder time understanding would be those who wished it were other than what it is. Yeah. And I was like, that's exactly basically how I feel about recommending this movie to other people. So with that said, I would highly recommend it. And what it does more than anything else is the same thing Gone Girl did. After a year of watching a lot of pretty good movies overall, I realized that I still think the best is yet to come. And it started with kind of Gone Girl and Fury. And I think November and December, we're going to get a lot of really great movies. And that just super excites me. Yeah. So, and that might start in a couple days. And Big Hero 6, Interstellar, all this is coming out this weekend. And it's just a piling of highly publicized and marketed movies after that. So I'm just so excited. So, well, I'm so excited anytime anyone wants to take this much of their time to talk movies with me. So I wanted to give you guys a chance to let people know how they can continue those conversations with you guys. So, Wade, how can people follow what you do in the social sphere?
Yeah. So probably the best way would be, to follow me on Twitter, and I'm at Wade Hance, Hance. And so, yeah, check me out there. And then you can go to my website, wadebearden.com. And what I like to do a lot of times is if I write for a place like Christ and Pop Culture, I'll link it on my blog. So the Fury review that I wrote, you can find that on Christ and Pop Culture. You can also find a link to it on my blog. And if you want to, if this hour and 30-minute discussion isn't enough for you, you can check out my review of Fury. And then also, I would love to connect with everyone on Letterboxd. Like we talked about this a little bit. I've fallen in love with Letterboxd. So I think it's Wade, you can search Wade Bearden, or I think it's letterboxd.com/Wade Hance. So connect with me on there, and yeah, no, I hope to hear from you. So Twitter, my website, or Letterboxd.
Cool. And we'll make sure we have all that in the show notes. Josh, how can people find what you're doing on the web?
Well, first, you can find me. I write 4 times a week for Real World Theology.
Sounds like a cool site.
I think it is. You know what, Fizz? Best job I ever had.
Best job I ever had.
Best job I ever had, man.
And if that's not enough for you, I echo Wade in that you can find me on Letterboxd. It's essentially a place that's like Facebook, but it takes off all the dross and leaves you with all the cool people that talk about movies. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle is at Jorsh Kreb. That's JORSHCREBB. I thought about changing that since I started doing the podcast, but I think I'll just leave it. I mean, those are two places you can basically reach me. Real World Theology and Letterboxd. I feel like such a movie nerd now that I'm not even like, don't even look for me on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for me on Letterboxd and on a website about movies. It's glorious.
You have arrived.
I have.
Welcome to the club that we just started.
That we just started, yes.
Well, you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. You can also follow the show at Real World Theo on Twitter. If you want to keep the conversation going about this specifically, go to realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com, where you can find this show, the show notes, lots of other shows. You can comment. We'll comment back. We'll just tell us where we're wrong. Tell us where we're right. Tell us what you loved about the movie. We, like I said, obviously, we have a club now where we talk about movies because we love them so much. So come be a part of the club. Connect with us on Facebook at our Facebook page. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. If you enjoy it, please, please, please review the show. Let's bump our rankings. Get more people involved in the conversation. Tell your friends, especially if you have positive things to say. And I just want to, again, like I said, thank my guests for being here. It's always awesome to have people who love to talk about movies for an hour and a half. So thanks, Wade. Thanks, Josh.
Hey, thanks for allowing me to be on here. I always enjoy talking. And yeah, I'd love to be on, you know, again in the future.
Well, we'll see what we can do.
We'll see what we can do. No, you know, maybe.
It's kind of an exclusive club. And I also wanted to thank the listeners. Thanks for taking time to make us a part of your week. And, you know, until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Awesome.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.